Welcome to History and D&D. In the last two episodes, 9 and 10, I discussed Dragonlance. Prior to that, in episode 8, I discussed big campaigns after stating in episode 7 that the next episode would be about roleplaying. So, this is the episode about roleplaying. First off, I'd like to discuss an idea that seems to always circle around the topic of roleplaying. The idea that combat isn't roleplaying. Or, to be more precise, that roleplaying only occurs when players interact with an imaginary world in a non-combative way. This thinking is wrong. I don't even think it's subjectively wrong. Just think about it logically. A player controls a character, therefore that character is a role. They use that character to play the game. Any use in the game of that character is the player using a role to play the game. Role. Play. Combat is an aspect of the game in which the player directs the action of the role or the character they play to achieve an objective within the combat. Just like how in every non-combat aspect of the game, the player has an objective and they utilize the character to achieve their objective. I bring this up because at some point, probably in the 90s, it became fashionable to deride combat-focused RPGs as lesser than games because there wasn't any or there was less role-playing than other newer games at the time. I started to notice the sentiment when Vampire the Masquerade first hit shelves. My friends and I played that and other games made by indie publishers. During this time, as other modernized games came out and many in the RPG community began to praise the new games for their role-playing and made claims that older games like D&D had inferior role-playing or lacked it altogether. I never really questioned it back then because that sentiment only began to grow as I slowly moved away from RPGs. I noticed it more and more on BBSs and later forums, but I didn't go deep into the reads. By the time I got back into role-playing games with the release of 5th edition D&D back in 2014, this idea had come to seem like the default. But there was a new twist. You could homebrew D&D to make it more like those other games. I guess this was just a snowball effect from the 90s, as all the articles and later videos about how to get your players to roleplay or how to roleplay better yourself solidified the idea. The new default idea was that combat, random encounters, dungeon crawls, and murder hoboing were bad. Talking to NPCs was good. I contend that they're all good, depending on whatever you like. But more importantly, they're all roleplaying. Lately, I've been seeing some pushback into labeling combat as roleplaying again. But now people suggest capital R for real role-playing and small r for the other kind, which is mostly combat. This is still incorrect. As I stated, any use of the character is as much role-playing as any other. There is no distinction that needs to be made. If your group prefers less or zero combat, you're role-playing, just as if another group is if they prefer only or mostly combat. Is their game different? Sure. But both of you are playing roles. In Running the Game number 83, Matt Colville outlines in his YouTube video the differences he sees in the two kinds of roleplay experiences. This was one of the earliest pushbacks once the idea that combat was not roleplay had seemingly become the default by 2019. About 3 minutes into the video, he discusses the idea that many people want to raise roleplaying onto a pedestal and make it into this virtuous pursuit. This is likely the sentiment that led to the idea that combat isn't roleplaying. Back before the 2000s, in the early history of the RPGs, anyone who played a role-playing game was a nerd, a geek, or possibly a Satanist. In any case, they were looked down upon almost universally. So it makes sense that most of us wanted to stand our ground and say, no, this game has worth, and therefore I have worth. Eventually, this morphed into the hypothesis that role-playing was a virtuous thing, and we were quick to glom on to any mainstream source that exemplified the virtues of our hobby. This created the snowball effect, a self-fulfilling prophecy. Now we have all kinds of studies on the virtues and benefits of our hobby. Maybe it's all true, maybe none of it is, but we started to take it as a given, and then the mainstream bought into it further. In any case, at the same time, the idea of one type of role-playing being good and the other type not being role-playing, not good, or not quite as good, got caught up in all this. The hypothesis and the idea intertwined into a theory that morphed into a philosophy. And now we're in this place in which the overriding narrative is that role-playing is great, the best thing ever, and it's great for everyone. It'll improve your life and mental health. But also, there are things that aren't good, but these things aren't role-playing. So ignore them. Just do the things that are, the only things that are role-playing. The people that do the other things are unsophisticated and geeky. Wow. I just realized we're about to come full circle. Anyway, about 5 minutes into the video, Matt proposes the uppercase and lowercase R roleplay theory. Back in 2019, this was the first time I heard this version of the theory, or at least heard it presented this way in a direct manner. I think the theory had been cultivating in various places online for a few years. I can see the appeal of the idea because it's an apology in the philosophical sense. What's that? It's generally a reasoned argument or writing in justification of something. So of course, fans of D&D, a mostly combat-focused game, would be in favor of an apology justification for the focus of their game. But I think it falls far too short of the mark. Of course, you could probably gather I'd say that because I've already stated that I see all aspects of the game as equals, that therefore it would follow, but I don't see any need to justify one aspect in relation to the other. And I certainly don't accept that calling one capital R role-playing and the other small R role-playing solves any problem, because I never accepted that there was a problem. They're both small R role-playing, because the only time role-playing is capitalized is when it follows a punctuation mark that requires capitalization, or you're writing out role-playing game to define the acronym RPG. Matt's capital small R theory is slightly different than the main theory. He defines it as acting like your character as opposed to your character acting as an extension of you, whereas the more normative version simply separates combat and non-combat. But while Matt has a nice idea, I see no distinction. Even if you are playing a character that you've decided is an extension of you, there's no way that it really is you, or that you'd make the same choices as your character. There are a myriad of various reasons for this. Time, place, culture, laws, equipment, training, lack of real-world consequences, and especially the fact that the entire scenario is made up, whereas your life is real. So even if you or someone else thinks your character is acting just like you would, there's no way that's even possible. And an idealized version of you is definitely not you, because you are not an idealized version of yourself. The remainder of the video is about the various dimensions to a character, and it's a very interesting discussion. I would just add that, like Matt, I don't think multidimensional characters are better than non-dimensional ones. The idea of role-playing as a virtue continues to expand. Jarn Arcadian, in his TED Talk, discusses the idea that several studies, mostly about childhood, show that structured social games like playing house, cops and robbers, firefighting, and eventually RPGs, help individuals improve their interpersonal and communication skills and help them navigate various situations because they have practiced social cohesion in a simulation where failure doesn't have the same consequences as a real-world situation would, meaning that the outcomes in these simulations don't matter at all in comparison to the outcomes of real-world ones. Now, I again think much of this is overstated in general, especially when equating it to role-playing games, but I don't think it has zero benefit. It depends on the person, the game experiences, and the later real-world situations. I think it can be generally said that there are some positive gains in real life that can be influenced by the practice we received from games we've played. It's also interesting that the real-world examples he gave involve his friends using characters that were hyper-realizations of their current real-world situation, and that they use those characters to navigate and test out scenarios and actions before trying them in the real world, where there would be real-world consequences. This kind of encapsulates the idea of playing a version of yourself, as well as it ties into some studies I'll mention later. It suggests that it has benefit, but I would also suggest that even characters one would consider complete fabrications, completely unlike themselves, are probably not that. I suspect that creating a character that you think is nothing like you is really just taking an aspect of yourself that may be partially or completely unexplored and exploring it, letting it live and breathe. I also suspect that a player who does this, if they see it as a success, might actually allow themselves to incorporate this aspect as a realized personality trait to some or large degree for a short or long time. So is there really any point where someone is role-playing a character which is completely not them? Probably not. Just like there is probably no point where someone is playing a character that is completely like them. I use the Matt Colville and John Arcadian discussions as a contrast because the type of role-playing they describe were almost opposites. I, for one, think that they're both overstated and that the truth is somewhere in the middle. While one thinks that a higher form of role-playing is playing a character unlike yourself, and the other sees greater benefit in playing a character like yourself, I think neither and both is the better answer. One thing that has really contributed to a new philosophy of role-playing, beyond just the increased attention and therefore more articles and videos, is that more and more games are available to listen to or watch through streaming and podcasts. This means that there is an audience for other people's games. RPGs in general did not have an audience before 2010. Once you include an audience, that audience influences the thing they are consuming, and it influences them. The streamers and podcasters are generally trying to reach a growing audience, and they will start to at least partially tailor their game, which is now a product, to the seeming desires of their audience. The audience themselves will want to be entertained. The main way of being entertained by a role-playing game is to play said game, but the audience is not doing that. So they'll have to find a different way to be entertained. It logically follows that some of this new philosophy of role-playing is helpful in this aspect. It's a little like acting at that point. But it also is probable that it would increase the likelihood that an audience member will create or join their own role-playing game. And I would suspect that most of the time, they would attempt to emulate the games that they have been an audience to. I think this might be what is narrowing the scope of what others consider role-playing. Of course, I'm not the only or the first person to make this assertion, but I think I have not heard others express the connection between this particular phenomenon and a new philosophy of role-playing. Here's an example of a particular situation gone awry eventually. A YouTuber named Sarah Z outlined the entire situation in great detail, 2 hours of detail. Because I dealt with something related to this podcast that I was writing, I watched the whole thing, despite having almost no knowledge that these people even existed. Which I guess is ironic when I get into the next bit. That next bit is a word in its definition, parasocial. In this context, parasocial is a psychologically one-sided relationship between a celebrity and their fans. A fan can feel like the celebrity is their friend, while the celebrity has no idea that they even exist. I bet you can feel the hairs on your neck rising as you think about the bad places this can lead. I'm sure many people are aware of crazy fans who try to harm celebrities, their families, or others because they got lost in their devotion to the celebrity. Most well-known examples include John Lennon being shot and killed by his fan, Mark David Chapman, and Ronald Reagan being shot by John Hinckley Jr. in an attempt to impress actress Jodie Foster. Obviously, those are extreme examples, but I'm not convinced there's anything beneficial about treating someone you never met as if you have some sort of relationship with them. I mean, I find it odd when anyone posts on Facebook or Twitter about any celebrity death. Of course, I understand that this is normal behavior amongst humans, despite the fact that I think it's dumb. I do a lot of dumb things, but I just don't understand how you can have any real feelings for someone you have no real relationship with. Here's an example of how I interact with media. Episode 9 was the shittiest Star Wars movie, and I was a little bummed that there may have never been a good Star Wars property again, and also that the culmination of 3 trilogies was the dumbest shit ever. But I guess I just stopped watching any new Star Wars things if they kept being like Episode 9. I wasn't angry, indignant, or demanding that they undo, redo, or make penance for it. So that's all to say that I'm probably not all that sympathetic towards those that feel betrayed or ignored by a celebrity. I just don't care. My reaction to when a piece of entertainment or information ceases to be entertaining or informative is to turn to some other source for those things. That's it. But back to the Adventure Zone. The McElroys apparently cultivated, either knowingly or unknowingly, a very parasocial relationship with their audience. I have no idea. I think I may have heard of them once or twice on Dragon Talk, but I don't remember. I could look it up, but I bet the reason I don't remember is that they bored me. That's to say, whatever it was they were doing appealed to me not at all, so I have no idea about anything in regards to their brand of entertainment. In this case, I have to take Sarah Z's word for everything that went down with them. She seems quite knowledgeable, and her video seems to take multiple perspectives, so I've decided to trust what she has presented as the truth. The relationship that they cultivated with their audience was performative in that much of it may not have been genuine, but instead based on what they think their audience wanted, which is kind of what I was alluding to before when I spoke about role-playing games with audiences. In addition, they built themselves as a family brand, which was true. They were a family. But this led to their community feeling as if they too were a family. Lots of communities feel this way, but I think many also place the focal celebrity outside the community if members of the community don't have any meaningful interaction with the celebrity. While the community members have meaningful interactions amongst themselves, I think most of them recognize that they don't necessarily need, nor will they get that with the celebrity. They are generally content with this. They can admire their work, be thankful of the entertainment provided, and respect the distance between them. Anyway, this doesn't seem to be the case with the McMillan. And maybe this was partly their fault. So what ended up happening was many of their fans felt betrayed by things the brothers had said in the past or present, or by new lackluster storylines in their campaigns, or characters and situations they decided were problematic. This all culminated sometime around 2019, as much of their fan base began to reject them. From what I understand in the video, it just kind of blew up in their face, and the exuberance of the fan base fizzled. This is an example of not only trying to run a role-playing game and catering it to an audience, as well as crafting the campaign around the conflicting whims of a growing fan base. They have no idea what they want, because they're all very different people. However, they see this game, which I think is supposed to be a much more personal and intimate experience, and they want it shaped to their needs. But it should have been shaped to the participants' needs, i.e. the McElroys. Then, if there was an audience that enjoyed that experience, at least they'd be able to provide it because it was more genuine and sustainable. Going back to John Arcadian, some of the things he talks about ring true and seem to be supported by other materials. Role-playing seems to allow an individual to simulate experiences so that we can deal with them in a virtual environment. Real life is a more robust way of doing this because the stakes are higher, but role-playing may very well test the waters with little or no consequences. Humans are in a constant state of flux, and personality is also fluctuating. Maybe both role-playing and real life allow an individual to fine-tune their self, their personality, and the image they present to others. A study out of Stanford titled Virtual Self-Modeling by Jess Fox and Jeremy Balinson presented findings that an individual was more likely to change their behavior in the real world as a result of the use of an avatar's behavior in a simulation if they identified with that avatar because the avatar was similar to them. As an example of behavioral change, a paper from the New York Academy of Sciences by Hal E. Hirschfield titled Future Self-Continuity provided evidence that an individual was more likely to increase their savings and investments if they were presented with a virtual reality of their future life. Studies like these do seem to suggest that, given the right circumstances, role-playing can be beneficial and lead to self-improvement. But I think some people rate such studies too high and exaggerate the benefits to their hobby. This leads into a philosophy of role-playing that may be built around misconceptions. A new addition to the how to role-play philosophy is the idea of a session zero. At its most basic, the zero session is a beginning meeting between participants where they flesh out the general milieu, and characters of the game they intend to play. Expanding on that has them defining what is allowed and not allowed in the game. This can include rules, homebrew, or otherwise, but also increasingly includes removing social and emotional elements that a player has an aversion to. I'm not opposing to adjusting games in this way, but I'm still opposed to the idea of a session zero. For one, I'm opposed to too much formalization of social customs across a wide consumer market for a game that, to me, is a personal experience. What I mean is, this is how you're supposed to play a unique game is a contradiction, and I often reject the idea that certain things are supposed to be any certain way in general. But two, I think that session zero is pointless because any adjustments that need to be made to the game to provide enjoyment of the participants shouldn't be written in stone at the very beginning, but should instead be continually adjusted. This is because, again, almost everything is situational and because I think humans are very good at continual negotiations and therefore should use their social skills and empathy to continually deliberate these things as necessary rather than rely on a game Bible to dictate their future enjoyment of said game. Of course, much of the time, one or more persons clash with the others, and this is usually a good opportunity for all participants to hone their skills in conflict resolution. Mostly, the participants can find a compromise in the conflict, but often they cannot. This is also fine, because the person or persons may have to separate themselves from each other as they are at an impasse. There's often an aversion to leaving a game or removing someone from a game, but there's nothing unusual or necessarily worrisome about this. Sometimes people just aren't looking for the same things and shouldn't have to subvert their expectations for others, and it's often the case that some people are not destined to get along. So there's nothing wrong with these individuals separating themselves from one another, either temporarily or permanently. In any case, a session zero is not going to solve this problem before it happens, as its promoters believe. It's more likely to just kick the ball further down the road until they can't resolve it due to it being unresolvable, or that they don't have the skills to resolve it due to the fact that they've relied on formal systems to resolve their social issues rather than their own intellect. I've seen too many players in groups and forums asking for help with the social situation, and the help they receive is inadequate because so many of the respondents reply with, "This is what a session zero is for," except that it's not, because most often the people asking for help have dutifully performed the holy session zero, and it has now failed to resolve the actual problem. The respondents have no further advice. I think that if, however, most of these people who required help skipped the session zero and continually discussed the game outside and inside the game with each other, they would be more likely to reach a point of equilibrium of what they each want in the game. And if that doesn't happen, the only answer is for individuals who cannot harmonize with the others to leave the game. You might know this before a game if you're perceptive, but no one is going to know it just because they perform the proper rites as laid out by the Almighty Church of Session Zero. Session Zero is just a crutch and a rickety one at that. It's also not role-playing, but is increasingly held up as an important aspect of role-playing games. Bupkis, gotta say. I think these How to Roleplay Better or Get Your Group to Roleplay Better videos and blogs set up this expectation in a person, and they're more likely to foist a style of play that the other members of the group are not ready for or not interested in. All that you really have to do to roleplay well is pretend that you are actually the character are in the situation being described, and you need to decide how you, as the character, would attempt to resolve the situation. The more you think like this when you first start to play, the more it becomes a habit. 11 Ways to Be a Better Role Player by Grant in 2013 in a blog on Look Robot has some excellent advice for players and maybe one of the earliest examples as such of that type of article. It may even be an originator that influenced some of the thinking as it evolved in time, because I can see some things in it that pop up these days. One example is that if you make a character that lacks motivation for adventure, and you require a lot of cajoling from the other players or DM to get you to participate, then you should scrap that character and make an adventurer. A long time and often discussed aspect of RPGs is metagaming. This used to be a huge buzzword in the past, but I don't hear about it as often these days. Either that means people don't do it as much, or they don't care about it as much. I suspect the latter. What is metagaming? It's simply talking about the elements of the game within the game. The simplest example is your character acting with the awareness of the game, or acting as if they understand that when they swing their sword, a d20 is being rolled to determine the outcome. Some people expand this to include creating characters to game the system, meaning they want to optimize a character within the rules so that they can deal with the mechanics of the game more efficiently. But I don't consider this metagaming. Here's why. The most common type of character like this is a character with high damage output, which is desired because they resolve combat in their favor better. But equally, a character that is fluffy, cute, interactive, and unique is metagaming because the player has certain aspects of the game they want to play out in a certain way. Just because it's not a by-the-numbers approach doesn't mean that their intent isn't to game the game. Almost all characters have some aspect of this, and it's generally a necessary part of the fun. A player wants to create a character that interacts with the game in a certain way because they desire certain outcomes within the game. Meta is a Greek word that originally meant comprehensive or transcending. However, when used in English and attached to a noun, it generally means self-referential. So meta-emotion means emotion about emotions. Meta-joke means joke about jokes. And meta-game means game about games. As I said before, gaming the game or gaming the system of the game. I take the Greek meaning of meta, specifically the transcending part. The most famous example of this is the meta referencing of breaking the fourth wall. This comes from theater, where it is generally assumed that the players, or actors, are surrounded by four walls, even if only three or less of them are seen. The fourth wall is an invisible one between the audience and the players. When this is broken, the players are aware of their audience, and the characters that they play become aware of the fact that they exist in a fiction, and the audience becomes aware of all this. Lately, Deadpool is the most famous example of breaking the fourth wall. As in the comics and movies, he's aware of his fictional nature and that an audience exists. This is how I define metagaming. If the parts of the game that you manipulate are manipulated by you as if they are aware of their nature, such as my example above of a character knowing dice are being rolled and that a certain number will result in a certain outcome. Of course, technically, the gaming of the game definition is also true, but I contend that this is a constant and necessary part of the game, so there's little point in defining it that way if the purpose is to stop people from doing it. If a player creates a character that interacts with the game you've created in a disruptive way, just tell the player to redesign the character or remove it from the game. There's an RPG beginner's guide posted on the Reddit wiki. Also, I had no idea there was a Reddit wiki before this. It's a little ridiculous. It has some useful information, but it's filled with pointless things you can ignore. I bring it up because it does seem to be a melting pot of the kinds of tips people give elsewhere online that just fill a player's head with obligations. The etiquette section is full of this type of stuff. It advises to get up from your seat if you're not in the game at a convention, never bring along an unexpected guest without discussing it with the host, pay for the host, guides, food, or drink, check with the people before bringing food, drink, and alcohol, and to not touch someone else's dice, miniatures, or character sheets, among other things. My answer to this is just no. Rules like this are only necessary if you're unable to determine through normal social interactions what the actual etiquette is between people. Generally, it takes longer to do this with strangers. I would say that if anyone gets bent out of shape about someone not following these etiquette rules, stop playing with them immediately. They're a problem. However, if someone asks you to abide by similar etiquette and you do the opposite, then you are the problem. My advice is that if rules like this are too formal for you, like they are for me, find a more laid-back individual. Conversely, if the people in your game are too laid-back for you and you want more formal etiquette, seek other people with sticks up their asses to play with. And just to point out the absurdity of hard and fast rules like this, I'll take the examples of food and drink. You are under no obligation to bring food and drink for your host and or game master. Is it a nice thing to do? Sure. And I would appreciate to some degree and would reciprocate at a later date. But let's say you bring me vegan or gluten-free food. I'm not going to eat that shit. Now, I still have to get my own food and you feel bad for no reason. Or if you're the kind of person who likes to drink alcohol or smoke pot while gaming, I don't, generally. But I have lots of friends that do. However, if any of my friends who are recovering addicts were playing, I'd make sure I let those people know not to bring those substances, and they could decide if they still wanted to attend. My main point throughout all this is that everything is situational. Every social situation can see someone make a mistake, but humans are very good at working things out in a calm and rational manner to suit the particular group dynamics, so that formal rules designed to fit every situation under the sun are just wrong. One new concept that I do like, that I first heard expressed by Matt Colville, is that the player is responsible for player things, and the DM is responsible for everything else. Breaking this down means that if it's on your character sheet or relates to it, you're responsible for it. What does that responsibility mean? It means you have to be able to know how it works, be able to explain it to others, and control its use. If you're a new player, of course the other members of your group can help you, but you should not rely on this in perpetuity. If you learn a new rule, learn it and understand it so that the next time you don't have to relearn. As an example of what this idea means, in combat for the first time, it's okay for the DM and other players to explain that you can cast Magic Missile and how it works, but over the course of many combats, you will later be explaining to them what you can do, what you will do, and how those things work. So here's my philosophy on all this. As I've said, role-playing is simply having a role, i.e. a character, and playing a role in the game. It doesn't matter if you segment the game into combat, non-combat, negotiation, NPC interaction, puzzle deciphering, etc. You're playing a game and a role in that game. It also doesn't matter if you specifically go out of your way to act as your character would act as opposed to yourself. It doesn't matter if your character was designed to be wildly different than you or as a fantastic extension of you. They're basically the same. The former is maybe more intentional than the latter, but at the end of the day, both characters have an imaginary existence that does not in any way mirror your own. So anything you decide for the character to do will unlikely be something you do, because the environment is wildly different and imaginary. It's about the same as thinking about a confrontation you had the day before, and imagining you had said or done something different, how you could have had a more favorable outcome. You didn't say or do anything different, and you can't go back and change it. The situation and outcome remain as they are, but you have created an imaginary scenario in your head to deal with something and imagined a different outcome. I don't really see much difference between creating a character that you intentionally or accidentally make as a version of yourself versus a character that you intentionally or accidentally make to be unlike you, as both are you and not you at the same time. We always make Schrödinger's character. The character we make must always be somewhat like us and somewhat unlike us. Maybe there are matters of degree to that, and maybe the distinction matters. But if it does, it would likely be situational. Putting all this together, the idea that there is a better kind of role-playing is just incorrect. Just like most things in life, one thing is not better than another. Things are situational and depend on the person, place, time, location, environment, and so on. Each type of gradation of role-playing you or someone else segments away from the basic role-playing is situational. It all depends on what the players of that particular game at that particular table want from their game. Essentially, it's about what they think is fun at the time. And that's another emerging idea that's quickly turning into a philosophy with many theories. Fun. And what is fun for everybody? Spoilers, there isn't anything that's fun for everyone at the same time. Different people at different times and different places enjoy things in different ways. That's about the extent you can make an accurate generalization. One of the new branches of the how to have the best fun theories is the idea that the DM's job is to make sure the players have fun. That's a whole other topic that I might go deep into at a later date, but I'll let you know that it is absolutely not true. Every player, and the DM is a player, should have the responsibility to help each of the others have fun if any one of them should have that responsibility. This could be suspended in paid games where the players are paying a dungeon master to facilitate the game, but at that point, the DM can decide for themselves how much of their own fun they should subvert for the amusement of others and how much money they should be charged for such a service. In the end, the other players would be paying and the DM would be giving up his time and labor, so the DM should not accept an unfair wage for such a service. To sum up, role-playing is what you make it. If you're just starting out, you're not bad at it because there's no one else that's better at it. Don't buy into these magical formulas on how to become a better role player unless you and your group would actually enjoy incorporating aspects of them into your game. It's not a job, it's a hobby, a fun pastime. It shouldn't feel like a job unless someone is paying you to do it. There isn't a proper and improper way to go about it. Just wade in and react to it in the way that you naturally would. As you continue, the way you play may change, and that just means you found new ways to enjoy the experience. Don't tell others how to roleplay as if you've come down from Olympus to bring the secrets of fire. You're a nincompoop, just like the rest of us. You and other players are not required to emulate the playstyle of podcasts and streams. That's not the bar you have to reach. All that's required is you all have fun and that you all play as genuinely as you can. Just do your best. If someone says you're not doing it well, they're probably wrong, as there is no better or worse as long as you aren't being a dick. Basically, If you're playing, don't be a dick. If the other participants are saying that some of the stuff you're doing is dickish, stop doing those things. If you think their requests are unreasonable, then leave the group. Don't double down or try to convince other people that they should like things that they clearly don't. And I'll reiterate this, as I think it's important, and maybe what many people want to hear when role-playing is being discussed. Here's the only way to role-play. Imagine you are the character you created in situations described by the DM, and that the story you and your friends are creating together is as real as any other story. And then decide to do things with that character based on these assumptions. That's it. In the next episode, I'll look into the Lich, its history, and where it evolved to in D&D. This has been History and D&D. Hadad! I hope your day is free of thunderbolts.